So would it be really cool with a glowing plant to combine a carbon sequestration capability? And that if you put these two things together in just the right way, then it would be nifty to explore how much sequestration you could achieve, because you create a strong incentive for people to plant these because they're super pretty and aesthetically beautiful. And they also can serve a lot of functional use cases. Like imagine a mine, a coal mine or something like that, and you put moss on the walls and it glows red if methane is present. So it's a canary in a coal mine, or a nuclear power plant where if it leaks radiation, the trees glow red or something like that. So you create a strong incentive for people to plant these things, but then at the same time you create carbon. Well, if you create carbon sequestration, you can track them with a blockchain, and then you can tokenize the carbon and trade it. So blockchain never goes away. It's always there. There's always a thread there.
Welcome to the Encrypted Podcast, your gateway to the future of technology and innovation, right here in the heart of Dubai's dynamic tech universe. I'm your host, Maria Vovchok, and together with Dubai Blockchain Center, we are embarking on a journey that unravels the minds of tech visionaries through the digital frontiers that are shaping our world. Hello and welcome everyone to the Encrypted Podcast. I'm your host, Maria Vovchok, and today we're really happy to have Charles Hoskinson, technology entrepreneur and mathematician, who is a co-founder and CEO of blockchain engineering company Input Output Global Inc., formerly IOHK, and the Cardano blockchain platform. He's also a co-founder of the Ethereum blockchain platform. He was a founding chairman of the Bitcoin Foundation Education Committee and established the cryptocurrency research group in 2013. His current projects focus on educating people about cryptocurrency, being an evangelist on decentralization, and making cryptographic tools easier to use for the mainstream. This includes leading the research, design, and development of Cardano, a third generation cryptocurrency that launched in September of 2017. He also launched Hoskinson Health and Clinic. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Founded Hoskinson Center for Formal Mathematics, blockchain technology lab at Edinburgh, synthetic bio company with George Church and Ben Lam. And that is not all. So Charles, please tell us what our audience should definitely know about you that I haven't mentioned yet so far.
I just love exponential technologies. We live in a great age where a small group of people can get together and build things that influence the lives of billions of people. And whether it be in synthetic biology or it be in quantum computing or blockchain or AI, it's really exciting to be on the forefront of things and watch how quickly things can change.
So when you initiated Cardano, and at that time you had three principles that you also mentioned recently at the Cardano Summit in Dubai, how the vision, the initial vision of Cardano changed over years, and how is it right now, and how was it like from the beginning?
It stayed remarkably consistent throughout the years. So we thought a lot about what is required to build a system that's useful for millions to billions of people. And so you need scalability and interoperability and some notion of governance to be able to achieve that. So back in 2015, when we started Cardano, we were thinking from a first principles viewpoint, because at the time, we didn't really have good proof of stake protocols. We didn't have good security definitions of what is a blockchain and what makes it secure. There were a lot of heuristic things, like we'd learn a lot from proof of work, and there had been great projects like NXT, the projects like Peercoin, which gave us some indication of what is a good idea, but nobody had really taken a rigorous approach. And so one of the hallmarks of the Cardano project was the R&D side of it. Over 150 plus academics have gotten together all across the world, many different institutions, some you've mentioned. Others like Stanford, University of Wyoming, University of Connecticut, in addition to Tokyo Tech and University of Athens and Edinburgh. And we wrote almost 200 papers.
200 papers?
196, 10,000 citations, and they've gone to peer review at major venues like Eurocrypt and Crypto. And what these papers basically did is they kind of built the corpus of the entire science of blockchain to an extent to tell you what you can and can't do in these types of systems. So when people say scalability, what do they really mean? You know, when people say interoperability, what do they really mean? What are you allowed to do before the system starts falling apart or breaking? Mm-hmm. So we learned a lot. And then what we did is we translated that into code using a very particular way of writing code called formal methods. Mm-hmm. And that's how you write code for SpaceX when they're writing their, making software for their rockets, or if you're making a pacemaker. And you don't want a person's heart to stop or something, you need to know that the code works well. So we had to bring a lot of very smart engineers from many different countries together. And for about 7 years now, we've been chipping away at that first principles approach. And Cardano is now a thriving ecosystem with millions of wallets and lots of transactions. TVL is up 300% this year and 8 million user issued assets. So it's really been a joy to watch it go from a whiteboard to reality.
And actually, when you mentioned about interoperability, it's like one of the biggest, I would say, pains if we're talking about blockchains. And if it has been there like in 2019, and it's still like really relevant issue in 2023. So when we're talking about interoperability, how do you think the industry can overcome these interoperability challenges? And where do you think Cardano plays the major role in it?
So the biggest issue with interoperability is it's less about technology and it's more about incentives. And mm-hmm. so it would be almost like you have tokens with Wi-Fi routers and there's a Samsung token, an Apple token, and a Linksys token or something like that. If we lived in a world like that, then your phones just wouldn't connect to anything because you'd have to pay a toll for it. But the blockchain space operates this way. You have more than 30,000 different projects between the layer ones and layer twos, and many are tokenized. And people are given an incentive to create these walled gardens and basically maximize the value of their local token at the expense of the others. So there's not a strong incentive for people to talk about cross-chain infrastructure, mm-hmm. protocols, and these types of things. For example, you know, it would be really nice if you could call an Ethereum dApp and they could pay an ADA. And it would be really nice for, you know, an ADA dApp to be able to pay an Ether, these types of things. And protocols really don't behave this way. So we thought a lot about this. And we said, you know, you need some way of borrowing security and bridging between different systems. And we created a protocol called Midnight for this. Minotaur for this, which is in another project of ours called Midnight. But Minotaur is the first multi-resource consensus protocol. And what it does, it allows you to put proof of work and proof of stake and other protocols together. And you can pay the inflation of maintaining a system to multiple chains at the same time. So you could imagine borrowing some security from Bitcoin miners and from Ethereum validators and from Cardano nodes. Mm-hmm. And what that does is it gives an incentive for each of those ecosystems to keep that bridge alive. And that currency then can become a lingua franca. It can become kind of a common coin throughout. So that definitely will move interoperability in a productive direction. There do need to be cross-chain standards. And there's been a lot of discussion about what can you prove. Because another problem with interoperability is that if I send a transaction, let's say from Bitcoin to Cardano or mm-hmm. Bitcoin to Ethereum, well, the person on the Ethereum side or the Cardano side has to know something about Bitcoin in order to be able to validate that what they're seeing is legitimate and real. One of the big problems would be is if the only way they could do that, they have a full node, that can't scale uh-huh. because these nodes are huge and they have an enormous amount of information. So there is a question of what is the minimum viable amount of information to required in order to be able to prove that a transaction coming from one chain to another chain is legitimate. So there's been enormous progress in recursive snarks, enormous progress in checkpoints and just proof structures in general. And we've gone from a lot of hypothetical ideas to real protocols that use zero-knowledge cryptography that allow you to have very concise proofs, like proofs that are in the kilobyte range mm-hmm. that follow the transaction and they tell you that. So there's some combination of economics, some combination of incentives engineering, some combination of technology. And if they all come together, I think we can eventually get to an interoperable standard and the industry will get where it needs to go. Or you can be a maximalist like the Bitcoin people and say everything else is evil and only our chain is great. And if that's the way you believe it, that's the only other way to achieve interoperability is just interoperability through, you know, one standard, one chain.
Mm-hmm. What do you think right now is the biggest misconception people have about Cardano? Let's say if we're not talking about the Cardano community, because they probably know and they also watched your updates regarding Midnight and mm-hmm. Cardano Summit, like a lot of them. But let's say somebody is new to Cardano.
That there's no community, there's no progress, it's just a wallet, it's mm-hmm. a ghost chain, there's no dApps built on it, you can't build a dApp on it, it's one transaction per block. There are a lot of lies, and there's a lot of misconceptions.
But it's not built for DeFi. It's one of them that I read on the internet.
Which is great because Vitalik is now running around saying, hey, UTXO has merits, and we should start pulling some of these things into Ethereum. You know, the problem is that these are very complex systems, whether it be mm-hmm. Ethereum or Bitcoin or Cardano. And, you know, there's a lot of people floating around with PhDs in computer science that think about these things every single day. And what happens is that everybody seems to be an expert on these systems on Twitter when they have no real notion or knowledge of why they're built the way they're built, or the fact that there are very significant philosophical and technical differences. Uh-huh. You know, when you look at the accounting of Cardano, it was inspired from Bitcoin's accounting, and we added a smart contract notion to UTXO. This is a radically different way of doing things than a global state system that's non-deterministic, like a virtual machine, like the EVM. So there are trade-offs with these things. There are certain things that are much easier to do with an EVM. There are other things that are significantly harder to do. Like, for example, if your goal is to have a lot of off-chain transactions and state channels, kind of like Lightning, or Hydra or Plasma, it's a lot easier to do that in a UTXO system. It's a lot harder to do that in a system like the EVM, which is why Ethereum abandoned the Plasma program back around 2018, 2017. And they're starting to resurrect it with a UTXO system. So you have to take a step back and realize that there are nuances and they exist for a reason, mm-hmm. and that these systems aren't copy-paste of each other, and they all have their strengths and weaknesses. And misconceptions usually come when people are trying to focus on their favorite strengths and ask every chain to be the same. Solana is a great example. It's a very high throughput system, but there are humongous consequences to that. Unreliability and the fact that the chain sometimes goes down, but more pertinent, and I'd argue a bigger drawback, is that the consensus mechanism bloats the chain. I think the chain is well over 100 terabytes in size and continues to grow. The vast majority of the data that's in the Solana ecosystem has nothing to do with use cases and transaction volume. It has to do with consensus overhead. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like an engine that gives off a lot of smog or something like that. And the problem is, if you're a true blockchain, your security model is people storing the blockchain. So when you start getting to like a multi-petabyte chain, like, nobody can store it. Yes. So only one or two actors will have it. So the consensus model that they currently have leads to a lot of centralization. Now, if you don't care at all about decentralization, you just care about transaction fees and you just care about finality and all these other parameters, maybe that's an acceptable trade-off. And many people have decided if you care a lot about decentralization, then maybe that's an unacceptable trade-off. So there's room for a Solana and a Cardano and an Ethereum to coexist together because they carry different needs. Just like if you're a carpenter, you're going to have lots of tools in your workshop. And there's no such thing as one tool that does absolutely everything you'd ever want to do in woodworking. You need to have a diverse set of tools. So we tried to inculcate that attitude inside the space. And I think there's a broader misconception of maximalism, where people seem to believe in this universality of one set of trade-offs that are perfect and everything else is wrong. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just wrong.
Talking about strengths and weaknesses, because there's still, as well, on the internet, a lot of talks about the programming languages of Cardano. So how has using Haskell and type-based programming as the basis of Plutus aided or hindered development of Cardano? And how are you looking at using different programming languages in the future as well?
You know, isn't it a funny thing when you say, hey, we're going to go build an application for millions of people that's responsible for billions of dollars, but our developers are so stupid they can only program in JavaScript?
Nobody said about being stupid.
No, but here's the thing. It's every time you build something, mm-hmm. you have to build it with the right tools. And so you build a bridge. You mm-hmm. have specialized engineers come in. They use specialized tools. They're licensed. And they have to go through a very rigorous design process because every single day, thousands, if not tens of thousands of people cross that bridge. And if the engineer screws it up, people die. So nobody would say, gosh, how do we make bridge building tools so much more accessible and get mainstream people to come in and everyday people to come in and do this? Because they understand the gravity and the significance of mm-hmm. it. The same for a surgeon. You'd say, gosh, how do we make surgery more accessible? Okay, how do I get everyday people to be able to operate on me? You see, it's just so preposterous. So then you think about financial systems and applications that are in charge of people's money, their voice, their privacy, and at a scale of tens of millions, billions, hundreds of billions of dollars. Like look at Luna, $40 billion ecosystem. This is not a question of developer accessibility, in my view. This is a question of the right tools for the right job. So when you look at the stack of Cardano, what we thought through was, let's maximize the safety side of things. Mm-hmm. And let's think really carefully about where we can get strong evidence that when you write something, you've written it correctly, mm-hmm. so that it doesn't explode in your face. Now, what you can do is then start giving yourself more accessibility over time, and you do that by extending the protocol and adding domain-specific languages. Like, for example, we wrote Marlowe. It's one of the simplest programming languages in the world. Mm-hmm. Non-programmers can use it, and literally you can just click blocks together, and those blocks that click together will auto-generate a program. But Marlowe was designed in a way that every single execution path in the program can be verified, and thus you can get a proof that the program won't explode. Mm-hmm. And it's great for financial transactions. Now, further extensions allow you to add other models. And so it's very trivial to add the Ethereum virtual machine through extensions. And actually, it's already been done through Milcomata. DC Spark did this. So yeah, you can write Solidity code as well if that's something you want to do. But what happened with the Ethereum ecosystem is they made a big mistake in that they focused too much on rapid adoption. And we had a huge wave of things being built, and it led to over $100 billion of hacks and problems and scams and all these things and a lot of copy-paste stuff and projects cloning projects, and they have no clue how they even work. And then when something happens, you know, all these people lose their money. I think that was an unethical and an unwise way of doing things, and ultimately it hindered adoption. It hurt Fortune 500 adoption. It hurt government adoption. Like, Microsoft doesn't wake up and say, gosh, how do we get, you know, more users? They have 3 billion users. Google says the same thing. Apple, the same thing. Instead, they say, how do we preserve and protect the 3 billion users we have, and how do we not have a giant class action lawsuit if a problem happens? So they don't want to join or build on a system that has very unstable foundations that are a little milky and changing. So we thought a lot about it. We chose a very different approach. We said we're going to use a legacy of formal methods, a legacy of functional programming. These are the kinds of things that allow you to build it right the first time. And people can disagree, and there's certainly a lot of people in the industry who have, and that's okay. And that's why we created the Cardano partner chains concept, and that's why we write DSLs. And even in the Cardano ecosystem, there's disagreements. And what people are doing is they're actually writing their own programming languages and compiling them into Plutus Core. So, for example, there's a language called Aiken that was mm-hmm. created on Cardano, and Aiken is actually a Rust dialect. Mm-hmm. So it's very different than Haskell, and it's much more in line with what you'd see with Solang or, you know, these other languages floating around. And that's great. And we saw the same thing happen in the Java ecosystem with the Java virtual machine, where people like the JVM and they think it's awesome, but they hate Java. So what did they do? They created Scala and Clojure and Kotlin and all these other languages, Julia and so forth. And those languages, each and every one of them, have their trade-offs and their unique characteristics, but they all end up running in Java, mm-hmm. you know, at the end of the day. So that's also happening in the Cardano ecosystem, where we have this nice stable core, and we're starting to see some diversity in the DevEx. Another thing that people don't get is, no matter who you are and how great you are, how big of a company you are, it takes about 3 to 7 years for a mm-hmm. development ecosystem to grow out. So a great example would be Google. You know, they created the Go programming language. They created Dart. You know, they've done a lot of amazing things. Same for Microsoft with TypeScript. Same with the Scala ecosystem, the Python ecosystem. I remember 2015, Mozilla created Rust. And we looked at Rust in the early days. We said, gosh, this is a very immature language. It's fun and exciting and interesting and certainly performant, but it would be a nightmare building a cryptocurrency in it. Now in 2023, you know, just a few years later, it's the dominant language for writing cryptocurrency infrastructure and cryptographic engineering. But it takes, you know, 3 to 7 years for that to happen. So Plutus, as a mainstream language, is only about 2 years old. It's already gone through 2 major iterations. The third iteration is just about to come out, probably in March. And it's already gone from a fairly tricky thing to write applications into something that more than 200 different companies are building dApps in every single day. And they've built out libraries and pretty good tooling, and they've learned quite a bit. The other side of Plutus that makes it very difficult has nothing to do with language. It's the accounting model. Unless you're a Bitcoin Core developer, there's not many people that know how to program smart contracts or transaction chaining on UTXO. And so we kind of had to re-educate everybody, because a lot of people came into Cardano from an Ethereum-style model mm-hmm. thinking, oh, I'm just going to use a virtual machine and this is all going to work. And, oh, it's very different from the EVM. And so they kind of had to relearn how to build applications. And turns out it's there's an analogy in the computer science world. It was right in about 2004, 2005, when hardware started going from single core to multi-core. Mm-hmm. You know, when Intel said, hey, we now have the Core 2 Duo and these things. And the problem was that all software had to be rewritten. Mm-hmm. Because if you didn't write your software to take advantage of the other cores, it would only run on a single core, mm-hmm. you see? So we'll go through that step change and things get easier over time. And, you know, developers are picky people. And every year there's a new programming language because nobody wants to get along in that dimension. But I always just start from first principles, say, what are we trying to solve? And if we're talking about writing applications that can't fail, that are global, that run 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, where there are strong incentives for people to hack them and break them, and ultimately are in charge of billions of dollars or your privacy or your national election system or your national ID system, you kind of have to build that like a civil engineer would build a bridge or, you know, a hospital or any mission critical infrastructure. It has to be in a very systematic, deliberate way, or else very negative consequences happen, which we've already lived as an industry with over $100 billion in failures.
Dubai, home for innovations. Now I would like to touch the topic of decentralized ID, because you've been pretty vocal about that as well on social media. You've been actively discussing this. Which countries worldwide do you believe will be leaders in leveraging decentralized identity technology in the next couple of years?
So there's a house of concepts with respect to digital identity. So there's this concept of self-sovereign identity.
Yeah.
Then you have other things, just like how do I go from paper-based IDs to an identifier? Like Aadhaar, for example, in India is one of the largest digital identity system in the world. I think it has over 600 million people in it, but it's not blockchain-based. And you talk around a house of concepts, like how does it get issued? How does it get revoked? What level of portability do you have? Is it ubiquitous and used everywhere, or is it used in a scoped context? For example, if you're a member of the U.S. military or in the intelligence services, they have an identity system called CAC cards, common access cards. So there's a house of concepts there. So what we did in the cryptocurrency space is what we tried to do is create a standard that is as universal as possible and as portable as possible. And that standard is called the DID, the decentralized identifier. So this was the brainchild of Manu Sporny and Chris Allen, and they worked with the W3C to create this standard. They started in 2013. And I remember back then I met Manu down in New York. I said, how long do you think it'll take? He said, oh, just 2 years, we'll have it done. And it took till about 2022. So, you know, like it was only a few years off. But it was a very difficult thing because building identity is tough. But what's nice about the DID is now that it's out, it's a standard, it's very mature. We now have a unit of identity that can identify an autonomous agent, a smart contract, inventory in a supply chain, an NFT, a human being, a drone, and a self-driving vehicle, one universal identifier across the board. And what we've noticed is there's a whole house of identity products that are being built, like Hyperledger Indy or Microsoft Ion, or in the Cardano ecosystem, we built Atala Prism, that all agree to follow this. And so it doesn't matter what software stack has issued that DID and what software exists around it, you can move that credential seamlessly around between one database to another, one blockchain to another. And then you can start talking about building more sophisticated things on top of it. And where identity gets very exciting is when you talk about things like, for example, Anon creds or you know, other things in the zero knowledge world, where you can no longer live in a world of having to share information with people. So like when you go to a bar, for example, and they say, hey, I want a beer. If you're in America, they say, oh, show me your driver's license. Mm-hmm. Because you have to verify you're at or over the age of 21. Well, you don't just prove that. When you show your driver's license, they know your address, and they know your name, if you're an organ donor, and all these things. Well, wouldn't it be nice just to be able to prove the minimum viable piece of information? Like, are you at or over the age of 21? That's a yes, no question. Mm-hmm. Well, it's the same. Are you under U.S. jurisdiction? Are you an accredited investor? Is this pre-tax or post-tax money? Do you meet the suitability guidelines to participate in this crowd sale? Are you allowed to trade cryptocurrencies on my exchange? These basic questions, right? well, it would be really cool to have an identity stack where instead of you give me all your data and I hire a bunch of compliance people to dig through it and kind of think about it and say, okay, we think he's in compliance or she's in compliance. Instead, you just, settlement is compliance. You get the answer, the proof gives you what you need. And if you get hacked, all they see are a bunch of proofs. They don't see your name, your address, or all these other things. No one can keep personally identifiable information secure. We've learned this in the 21st century. The greatest example in the United States, there was a very famous hack a few years back called the OPM hack, the Office of Personnel Management. And this is where everybody in the United States on the military side who applied for a security clearance, whether they got it or not, they applied for it, their data got basically stolen. Mm-hmm. Well, the OPM is like, they collect so much information. An SF-86 form has over 100 pages in it. And they go do a very comprehensive FBI background check. And they know if you're gay or if you have a gambling problem and why your wife broke up with you and all these things. So when they got hacked, not only did those forms get leaked, but the FBI's SSBIs got leaked as well for 20 million Americans. And so nobody, you know, went to jail, nobody got fired. So if the U.S. government, for its spies and its military, is having trouble keeping personally identifiable information and investigation secure, what chance does a mid-size exchange or a startup have? Mm-hmm. So the only way you get out of this is you have to change the model, and you have to go to a model of portability, universality. And we achieved that as an industry with the DID. I think that's one of our biggest contributions to the blockchain industry and to the global commerce in general. But then second, you have to move to a model of only share the minimum viable amount of information necessary for the transaction to clear, and settlement is compliance. So we thought a lot about this, the Cardano ecosystem, and we built obviously a lot of great tools for it. And now we are huge evangelists to try to get this technology into as many places as possible, voting systems, national ID systems, because I think it's just so much better for the consumer. There's so much more privacy. There's no notion of passwords. It's super hard to get hacked. It's very easy to go from one system to the other system, so you reduce a lot of friction, and ultimately it gets a lot of businesses out of the business of being data warehouses and custodians, because they don't know what to do and they can't really handle it well.
I would also like to know your stance on a big elephant in the room, which is AI. How do you believe companies should govern so powerful as AI without having some good custodians behind it?
So AI is a really interesting thing. You know, large language models, they kind of blindsided the AI movement. So there were a lot of people like Ben Gortzel, or more traditional AI people like Norvig and others, who they were following a kind of an approach. And mm-hmm. then this LLM stuff was kind of being co-developed in the corner. And then it turned out that that's probably what's going to create artificial intelligence. And it's not very satisfying, because you don't know why it has these capabilities. They just become an emergence from having trillions of parameters and an enormous inference space and lots of data. But it is my belief, because of the way competition works, we'll probably have AGI before the end of the decade. Mm-hmm. So before 2030, we'll have some notion of artificial general intelligence. And when you really dig into it, there's three kind of rooms that force that to happen. Mm-hmm. First, just like with Bitcoin mining and crypto mining, when we went from CPUs and GPUs to ASICs, people are starting to create AI ASICs. It's called neuromorphic computing. And there, we no longer have to use these really expensive and very energy intensive GPUs. We can use different ways, they're called memristors. And that cuts the power consumption down by about 2 to 3 orders of magnitude. So your cost of training these models and inference in these models will become massively cheaper. So multi-trillion parameter models will come within the next 12, 24 months. Second, in terms of the data required to train these models, there's an emerging field in AI called synthetic data, where people are just inventing new data and they're using models to generate it. And this really helps to basically give you what you need to train these things, because in some cases there's stuff you need to train them, but it doesn't really come up much in nature. So think of computer vision, your Tesla. How often does like a semi-truck in front of you, suddenly its tires explode and it rolls and catches on fire? Maybe 1 in a billion, and it's so rare you won't see it, so your car won't know what to do. But you can synthetically create that scenario and put it into your training set. And if you do it in just the right way, it's actually as good as the real event. So there's a lot of startups that are starting to create synthetic data, and they're getting so good at it that within just a few years, they're going to be able to basically produce everything you could ever need and on demand. So you have much higher parameter counts, much lower inference cost in synthetic data. And then the final part is the tuning that aligns the systems and makes them useful for human beings, which is called RLHF, reinforcement learning with human feedback. That's a very time intensive, very expensive process. It takes a real long time, a lot of effort. Guys got to sit at a keyboard and kind of play with it and correct it and do scripts and these things. Well, what if you could do RLHF with AI? Mm-hmm. So reinforcement learning with AI feedback. So it turns out you can, and within the next 12, 24 months, that's probably going to be a better and faster way of training these models than using humans, and not just a little bit faster, exponentially faster. So every one of the inputs into LLMs to make LLMs more human-like and more scalable is going to be available via competition in the next 12 to 36 months. And then once you have these things in place, the AI makes the AI better. It's not humans making the AI better. So you have this exponential flywheel that just spins faster and faster. So there's an inevitability behind the creation of this. And I don't believe the solution is to close source all of it, because even if you tried, there's going to be some that escape and they still train just as fast in the open domain. And then, you know, you basically have this unaligned AI over here and these aligned AI here. So, well, that one wins. So I think you need to think in it differently and say, okay, well, how do we construct a governance layer for these things? And mm-hmm. I believe the blockchain industry could be that governance layer.
So it should be decentralized in this case.
Yeah, and you have to decentralize a whole host of things. You have to decentralize, you have to get talk about the data provenance and the ownership of the data, the royalty management, when people pay transaction fees to interface with it. It has to go in many different owners. Ultimately, the same things that govern protocol upgrades in a cryptocurrency would ultimately govern AI upgrades and the ownership of the AI system. But it's a difficult problem, and no one has really solved it. Alignment, many people consider to be a harder problem than achieving AGI. Mm-hmm. So you may need an AGI to align an AGI, and so that's a pretty problematic situation. So my hope would be that blockchain can sort out, at the very least, the ownership of the data and who can access and how to access, and it's a much better regulator than an executive order from a president or a central company making arbitrary decisions. On the other hand, I don't know if it is possible to regulate these types of systems. It would be like a bunch of gazelles coming together and trying to figure out how to regulate the lions. You know, these are very powerful systems, and unfortunately, competition is just going to create them. I don't believe there's any way to slow it down or stop it, because at the end of the day, no matter what, we saw this play out real time. OpenAI had a major breakthrough with QStar. They got very scared. They fired their CEO. They brought a person in who they felt would slow everything down. The minute they fired their CEO, Microsoft literally offered to reconstruct the company and steal 95% of the employees under Microsoft. So they decided to bring him back. Well, while all that was happening, Anthropic is still building Claude. While all that is happening, Google is going to be releasing Gemini in Q1 of next year. Mm-hmm. Facebook is training right now Llama 3, which is going to be just as powerful as GPT. And that's just on the American side. And then when you look at China, they have numerous LLMs that they're working on. It's the same in Europe. You know, there's tons of German companies and UK companies that are training. So there's just too many people working on it. And the incentives are too strong because people want to make trillions of dollars. So there's really no way to work against that kind of win. So we just have to accept that we're going to have it. And it's more of a question of, once we have it, is there a way we can decentralize it and then come up with a sensible regulation layer that sits on top of it? And that's one of the great challenges of our time.
Encrypted is your exclusive ticket to the epicenter of technological innovations in the MENA region. I also would like to talk about your other projects, because apart from Cardano, apart from, let's say, you being a mathematician, you have recently launched Hoskinson Health and Wellness Clinic. And recently, if I'm not mistaken, are you discussing some partnership with a famous clinic in the UAE? Tell us a bit more about this.
Well, I we're not partnered. I did tour today the Cleveland Clinic in Abu Dhabi, and mm-hmm. We certainly see centers of excellence. When it's always nice to, and it's an amazing facility, by the way, mm-hmm. the Cleveland Clinic there. It's extraordinary how quickly they constructed it too. It's a decentralized medical campus, but it's encapsulated in a single building so they can keep it at a reasonable temperature. But there's a great staff there. The ophthalmology department is incredible, and there's amazing people. But you know, Hoskinson Health and Wellness, what we do, there's kind of two parts to the business. First, in my family's background, you know, I was the oddball who liked mathematics, but the general trend was medicine. My brother's a doctor, my father's a doctor, my grandfather was a doctor, my uncle was a doctor. So there's just a ton of doctors floating around, or nurses or respiratory therapists. So there's more than 70 years of tradition of medicine in the family since the 1950s. And so given that we had that legacy and pedigree, I felt it was really important to construct something to honor that. And so we built a great primary care facility in Gillette, which is kind of a healthcare desert. They need three doctors for every one doctor that they have. So we built it just last year. We opened. Now we have over 5,000 patients, and we're on trajectory to grow to about 10 to 12,000 patients. And what we've been doing is kind of gradually adding, kind of like what the Emirates do. You know, you go to Dubai every year, there's more skyscrapers. Well, it's the same for us. So we have a lab opening in January, pharmacies opening soon, including compounding capabilities. We have an image center, and then we're opening a lifestyle component. So it does diet, nutrition, exercise, sleep, emotional health, and then a functional medicine practice. And we just kind of blend all this together. So one big side of the business is all about integrative holistic healthcare. So everything. So your allopathic, traditional, primary care, internal medicine style stuff, combined with a lot of things we've learned about diet, exercise, and sleep, and functional medicine, and how these are so radically important to your health and well-being so that we can create better health span. And doing it in a healthcare desert means that you take people who, in some cases, have to drive 100 kilometers or 150 kilometers just to see a doctor, and now it's in their backyard, and they can just go to the doctor. The other side of the business is research, and that's where we're very interested to talk to people like Buck Institute or the Cleveland Clinic or others. And the research side in particular are very interested in is the combination of hyperbarics and stem cells. So hyperbaric medicine is where you put a person in a high-pressure chamber for a period of time. And it turns out if you do that in just the right way, there's a very strong epigenetic expression. So you have your genes and your epigenome. Genes are kind of like your hardware, and your epigenome is kind of like the software. So which genes are turned on and off is your epigenome. And so when you go to a high-pressure environment, over 900 different genes turn on and off. And what it does is it tells your body release stem cells and heal itself. So it's no coincidence that we use hyperbarics to treat burns. Like, for example, there was a television late night person that got caught in a terrible fire and burnt part of his face off. And they put him into a hyperbaric chamber, and now he's nearly fully healed up. And then he also used for diabetic ulcers, traumatic brain injuries. In fact, China, one of the biggest use cases of hyperbarics is for stroke recovery. So most people remember hyperbarics for like, oh, diving medicine and like the bends and these things, but it turns out that's a small component of it. So we said it would be really cool to combine hyperbarics with mesenchymal stem cells, which are adult stem cells. And we believe that the combination of these two will have a great amplifying effect. So that's something we're very keen to study and to learn more about. So we'll start some human trials probably around 2025, 2026, depending on how quickly we can get through IRB and other things. And we have a very fertile environment to work with, and our hope is to diversify those human trials. So it'd be nice to run some of them here in Dubai and Abu Dhabi. And our goal would be to understand more about the rejuvenative and regenerative effects of combination of hyperbarics with stem cells. Now, what's really nice about that is we understand a lot about adult stem cells. We understand a huge amount about hyperbarics as medical practitioners, since they've been around for a very long time. So we know they're very safe and very effective within a window. It's easy to train physicians on how to use these protocols. And these are very scalable protocols, meaning that they can be scaled over a large population set. And if they're adult stem cells, you use what you harvest. And they're bioidentical, so there's no chance of rejection. So there's a lot of promise and merit there. But it's an area I'm very interested in. Because my biggest issue with medicine, Maria, is that I hate that most doctors wake up every day and their job is to manage the decline. So you get diabetes, you get heart disease, you get Parkinson's. And when you go see your physician, there's nothing they really do to cure you. They just say, here, take these drugs and we'll slow down the progression of these chronic ailments. But at the end of the day, they're going to kill you or make your life really bad. Well, what I'd like to do is spend part of my career figuring out, can we cure some of these things? And so you come in and after a few treatments, you're better. Mm-hmm. Like, I'll give you a great example. We have a device in my clinic for treating depression, which is...
Depression.
And depression is one of the worst things in America right now. I think there's more than 40, 50 million Americans that suffer from depression, and it just destroys people's quality of life. So the standard protocol for depression is antidepressants, so SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. And they work 20-30% of the time well for people. Most people see some form of improvement, a lot of people don't. And you just stay on them like a lingering drug. Well, it turns out there's a therapy that's FDA approved. It's called transcranial magnetic stimulation, and it has an equivalent or higher success rate to treating and curing depression about a third of the time. And you go in for 36 treatments, it uses magnets and helps rewire your brain, and for some magic reason it works. And it's very easy for us to apply. A psychiatrist maps the brain with the TMS device. We use MagStim at our clinic. It's one of the FDA approved devices. And after 36 treatments, a lot of people, about a third of the time, see a significant improvement, up to the, including not having to be on drugs anymore. Mm-hmm. I love stuff like that, where you just go, you get something done, and you're cured, or it's so much better that you've moved in the other direction, and you're not managing decline. So that's where medicine needs to go. We need a holistic approach to keep you healthy to begin with. That's why lifestyle medicine is so incredibly important and functional medicine is so incredibly important. But when you do get sick, we need to invest a lot of time, effort, money into cures. And unfortunately, the reason we don't do that in America is that it's not very profitable. You know, it runs contrary to the normal drug approval process and how drug companies make money. So, you know, I'm kind of outside of the system, and the family's been outside of the system, and nobody goes to Gillette, Wyoming, you know, and it's way out, it's 35,000 people, it's a coal mining town, and, you know, northeast Wyoming, which is already sparsely populated. So we kind of have the freedom to innovate and do things a little differently and have a lot of fun with it. There's a lot of blockchain applications that fall into that as well, especially on the medical record side, and being able to move medical records, better identity for the patients, those DIDs never go away. Mining medical records, you know, so the Midnight is a great example where you can use private smart contracts to harvest meaningful information from the medical records without exposing personally identifiable information to the patients. Mm-hmm. So that never goes away. You know, you can always find ways to pull that into the portfolio. But the core philosophy is just make people's lives better and try to cure them of what ails them.
That sounds really inspiring. What are the projects that you have, perhaps, that maybe focus on apart from Cardano, apart from Wellness Clinic? Because I know that you're working on a lot of things. Maybe you can share some more.
Well, the other thing that takes a lot of my time is synthetic biology. And I love plants. You know, I got a big ranch out in Wheatland, and I got forests there, and I love growing things, raised bed gardens. And these, and you go to my office, you'll see a lot of hydroponics inside of it. So I've always loved plants. I grew up in Hawaii before I moved to Colorado and Wyoming. And there it was great because you have orchids growing in your backyard. Oh. And it's like, if you can't grow something in Hawaii, you're the problem, not the plant. It's a fun place to be. And so I thought it would always been cool to do an ag tech where we actually use synthetic biology to explore genetically engineering plants to do interesting things. So in particular, I was very interested in combining two concepts together. One, I really wanted to make plants more exciting and sexy for everyday people. And the sexiest thing you can do to a plant is to actually make it glow in the dark. So what we're working on right now is to take pathways from fungus and bacteria and other sources and kind of modify them, genetically engineer them, and then transplant them through CRISPR into plants. We have two different model organisms we're working with and basically make them glow. Mm-hmm. So we're making huge progress, and I think in a very surprisingly short amount of time, we're actually going to be able to tweet something cool and exciting. But basically, that means I could put on this table here a plant, and then it glows in the dark, and it glows 24 hours a day. So there's a huge demand for that. You know, people want golf courses that glow in the dark. You know, it'd be organic lighting. So there's tons of rural areas around the world, and you know, it's too expensive to wire and light them. Well, what if you just plant trees and the trees glow? Now you have illuminated roadways, these types of things. So it's just awesome from an energy consumption viewpoint. The other concept is that many, many years ago, billions of years ago, we didn't really have a lot of oxygen floating around the atmosphere. And then we had cyanobacteria come, and when it evolved, it geoengineered and changed the entire climate, the entire atmosphere of the Earth. Mm-hmm. And then that oxygen led to the rise of us, you know. And so it turns out that if you have the right organism, you can actually change the entire atmosphere, the entire climate of the planet. So would it be really cool with a glowing plant to combine a carbon sequestration capability? And then if you put these two things together in just the right way, then it would be nifty to explore how much sequestration you could achieve, because you create a strong incentive for people to plant these because they're super pretty and aesthetically beautiful. And they also can serve a lot of functional use cases. Like imagine a mine, a coal mine or something like that, and you put moss on the walls and it glows red if methane is mm-hmm. present. So it's a canary in a coal mine, or a nuclear power plant where if it leaks radiation, the trees glow red or mm-hmm. something like that. So you create a strong incentive for people to plant these things, but then at the same time you create carbon. Well, if you create carbon sequestration, you can track them with a blockchain, and then you can tokenize the carbon and trade it. So blockchain never goes away. It's always there. There's always a thread there. So that's a fun venture. We started it with some people out of Harvard. That was George Church and Ben Lamb. Ben runs the company, and he's a great CEO, and you know, we're good partners. And he's based down in Dallas, and he works really hard every day. And it's going to be fun to watch that grow. But that said, you know, synthetic biology in general, that's just one use case. You can also do designer organisms. Mm-hmm. There's actually in Wyoming, there was a project years ago where they genetically engineered goats to produce spider silk in their milk.
Really?
Yeah, spider goats. How about that? And spider silk is stronger than steel. So imagine the textile industry where you can make a dress or a suit out of spider silk, and it's bulletproof and stab proof. That's pretty cool. And so there's tons of really interesting things that people are doing. And it, like every few years, this technology gets like a doubling. It's mm-hmm. just like Moore's Law. There's so many new capabilities that are coming online. The other thing is computer models and AI are getting super involved in the bioinformatics side. And so instead of having to be a genius and try to figure this all out yourself, you just tell the computer what you want, and it does this big calculation, and it tells you exactly what you need to put in the plasmid to basically engineer the plant or the animal to do that. So I'm very excited about that dimension, and you know how these things are going to move forward. And we're kind of in the forefront of it. You know, there's not many companies that are doing this at the moment, but I think that's going to be a multi-trillion-dollar business in the next 10 to 15 years. It is an industry as a whole, mm-hmm. the synthetic biology plank, and it's fun to be there at the beginning.
Amazing. Are you planning to bring this as well to the UAE?
Oh, God, it'd be great. You know, I suspect that Dubai will have a very strong interest in palm trees that glow in the dark and these types of
things.
That
would be interesting.
Actually, I tell you, probably the biggest market will be Saudi Arabia, because they're building Neom, and it would be interesting to pair Neom with a kind of a line of trees that go across the entire line that sequester all the carbon output of Saudi Arabia. But in general, I think this is going to be one of the strongest markets, the MENA in general, for these types of things. But remember, it's not just a tree or grass. You can create any organism. So it can be algae or seagrass or mm-hmm. coral, for example, that has a lot of great properties. And you can go beyond just bioluminescence. You can talk about coral, for example, that has better temperature regulation. So mm-hmm. as global warming increases yeah. and the oceans get hotter, you won't have coral bleaching because the coral is better adapted to that variation in temperature. You also can talk about de-extinction, which is what Colossal does, another company we're affiliated with, and bringing back the woolly mammoth. You know, they raised $150 million, and they have a war chest that will give them a decade to play around with bringing back dozens of extinct species, whether it be the thylacine or something else. And so it's really exciting to see where that goes, but it's necessary because the world is burning up. You know, we've lost more than half of our biodiversity over the last 70 years. And it's an extraordinary thing to think about that my great-grandfather, great-grandmother lived in an age that had twice as many species as we have today. Mm-hmm. You know, that was there's people in my family that knew those people, and they lived through that. So if this trend continues, you know, great-grandchildren, they're going to live in an age with half as many species as I had, you know, mm-hmm. growing up. And we can't keep doing that. It's so catastrophic. So what's cool about Symbio is it gives you a reset switch. You can kind of bring stuff back and you can kind of change things to adapt with the environment and eventually geoengineer and change the environment as a whole to make it more suitable for everybody. That's another passion of mine. And again, blockchain is so cool because you can use it to track all these genetically modified organisms, and you can kind of put a blockchain-based identity in each and every one of them, and you can put all the metadata and kind of understand in general how they're interfacing with the environment for positive and negative consequences.
Thank you so much, Charles. Today we had Charles Hoskinson. Right now we move to our rapid-fire questions. Rapid-fire questions. So right now, I'll be asking you quick questions, and you need to answer one or two words, like quick answers.
Sure.
Okay? Are you ready?
Yes.
Okay, if you had to explain blockchain to a child, how would you do this in one sentence?
Society decentralized.
Name five qualities you believe a real entrepreneur should have.
Five qualities?
Yes.
You have to have integrity, honesty, you have to have empathy, you have to be relentless and have a very high tolerance for pain.
What would you never do while building a company?
Never do while building. You always have to have a founder's agreement. If you don't have that, it's over.
The biggest misconception people have about you? About your personality?
Well, I guess people's opinion about my ego. Uh-huh.
If Cardano were a person, how would you describe its personality in one word?
Google Cardano, Girolamo Cardano. The Cardano was named after a person, and I hope that the ecosystem follows his personality.
What's your favorite programming language?
Scala.
The proudest moment in your blockchain career?
That was when Shelly shipped. That was an era of Cardano, and we finally got staking activated. It was a magical day.
Mm-hmm. The moment you would like to forget?
Oh, when I was pushed out of Ethereum.
Finish the sentence. My business philosophy is?
Allowing people to be their best and do their best work.
Mm-hmm. If there were a movie about your life, how would you call it?
Eventually True.
Describe a perfect day for you.
A perfect day is a day where we actually get everything done.
Uh-huh. Is it difficult every day?
There's too much to do in every day.
Uh-huh. What is the next big trend to follow?
Any exponential technology. So anything in AI, quantum, blockchain, nanotech, or Symbio.
What is your personal formula for success?
Just be relentless. Be passionate, be relentless, and actually care about the things you do, and you'll find success.
Dubai for you is associated with?
Garish opulence.
Thank you. Today we had Charles Hoskinson, co-founder of Cardano. There are many things that are coming and Charles Hoskinson will be sharing with us. Thank you so much for watching our Encrypted podcast. I'm your host, Maria Bovchok. See you next time. From the gleaming skyscrapers of Dubai to the innovation hubs of the Middle East and beyond, Encrypted brings you thought-provoking discussions, exclusive insights, and stories of innovation that will leave you inspired.